Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Eliza Griswold, the author of The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Lines Between Christianity and Islam. We'll discuss sectarian violence along the Christian-Muslim divide that is exploding in Nigeria, Sudan, and the Philippines as conflicts over religion, nationhood, and natural resources threaten to remake the world in the coming years. Then we'll talk with economist Dean Baker about his new e-book, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. We'll discuss the willingness of progressives to accept the conservative framing of political debates, where conservatives like the market while liberals like the government, which puts liberals in a position of seeming to want to tax the winners to help the losers. Then finally, we will challenge the recent prediction on the cover of Time magazine that Europe is about to collapse. Stephen Hill, the author of Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age, joins us. We'll explore the paradox that while we are told Europeans are facing bankruptcy, they nevertheless enjoy a higher standard of living than we do and continue to enjoy social services we can only dream of. Joining us now is Eliza Griswold, author of the new award-winning book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Lines Between Christianity and Islam. She is both a reporter and a poet who writes widely on religion, conflict, and human rights, and she's currently a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Her first book, a collection of poems called Wide Awake Field, received the 2010 Rome Prize from the American Academy in Rome. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eliza Griswold.
Thank you for having me.
And Eliza, of course, there was a bombing in Nigeria that connected to sectarian fault lines. I've talked a lot to people in the new country of southern Sudan who've been on the border, human rights monitors, etc. There's been decades of religious, ethnic, and racial violence there. Give us a sense of how much religion between the fault line, the tenth parallel, as you write about, between Christianity and Islam is driving this all of these subnational and transnational wars.
So religion plays a role in many of these conflicts along the tenth parallel, and we're really looking at the space between the equator and the line of latitude 700 miles to the north, the 10th parallel, across much of inland Africa and across Asia. And the reason that religion comes in, especially in Africa, we see this as something people fight about, has a lot to do with the fact that, and you touched on this with both Sudan and Nigeria, these are extremely weak states, you know, drawn by colonial administrators on maps. These lines never meant much to anyone. And in many of the places, and this is certainly true in Nigeria and Sudan, the state has traditionally been weak at best, rapacious at worst. And so for both your average Nigerian and your average person in southern Sudan, different forms of identity come to the fore. And even more than ethnicity, race, or really even tribe, religion becomes the most important common denominator.
But Eliza, these states may be poor, but they're rich in resources, Nigeria being oil, and Sudan, by the way, sitting on a lot of oil, with the paradox, of course, that the pipelines go through the north, whereas the fields are in the south in this new country.
Exactly right. So, you know, Nigeria is America's fifth largest supplier of oil, and the most populous country in Africa, and yet more than half of its population lives on $1 to $2 a day. And that enormous gap between rich and poor, which we're seeing emerge more profoundly here in the United States as well, but that leads people to a Nigerian cannot turn to his government to safeguard. He doesn't get a free education, he doesn't get clean water, he doesn't get a good road, he doesn't get electricity. To get those things, particularly in the Middle Belt, particularly in the towns we're talking about along the 10th parallel, you turn to your local imam or your local pastor. You become part of a group to advocate for your communal rights, and that communal identity is usually religion.
There also seems to be intra-religious fault lines. I've been speaking a lot with specialists on the Middle East, talking about the emerging Sunni-Shia divide. And as you know, the Shia Iranian regime is supporting the minority Shia regime in Syria. against the majority Sunni, and there's a rivalry between the Sunni kings and the theocratic regime in Tehran that's trying to spread its influence in what is called the Shia arc, or the Shia crescent, I should say. And the impression one gets is that this is a tinderbox.
Indeed. In fact, I'd say after 7 years of traveling along this fault line where, you know, more than half of the world's Muslims meet more than half of the world's Christians, the most overarching conclusion I could draw and do draw in the book is that the most important religious struggles of our times are those inside of religions, not between them. They're the struggles between Muslims and Muslims, as you were talking about, or Christians and Christians, over who has the right to speak for God and why. In particular, you were talking about Boko Haram. That's the group, which means loosely Western education forbidden. Then they are from a place called Maiduguri in northern Nigeria. This is the group that attacked the UN building in Abuja, which lies almost smack along the 10th parallel. And I actually had an unfortunate run-in that I don't write much about in the book because I didn't write about sort of the hairier adventures very much. But I was actually attacked, along with the photographer Seamus Murphy, by a mob of these guys. They also call themselves Nigerian Taliban. Okay, so they attacked our car. We were almost killed. And much more importantly, our translator really almost lost his life.
So given the experience you had with a near-death experience in Nigeria, and I take it that at the hands of the Salafists or the Wahhabis, which is a sort of alien, particularly in, as you mentioned, in the Sufi areas. Nevertheless, it's growing in influence because of the petrodollars that pumped into it by the Saudis, who have been propagating this form of Islam for decades.
Certainly, in regard to, and this is probably one of the most powerful and underreported stories actually happening today. In West Africa, in Nigeria alone, there are roughly 23 million young people, young Muslims, who go to exactly what you're talking about, the madrasas that the Saudi Arabia funded primarily in Pakistan that certainly has given rise to the Taliban. There are the same kind of schooling happens in West Africa. And this is one of those weird lines in which climate change actually plays a role in hardening religious lines, because there are these vast numbers, 23 million in Nigeria alone. So in West Africa, that number's probably quadruple, although I'm always suspicious of figures. But these guys travel to go to school. They go to their Islamic education for free. And what's happening is they used to be educated for free. These are called Omajri youth. They just mean madrasa students. They used to be educated for free because they went to farms, essentially. So in exchange for learning, traditional Islamic learning, and the teaching was very, very good in many of these schools, they did farming for the teachers. Well, what's happening as a result of climate change and the increasing creep of the desert in West Africa is that these teachers can no longer sustain farms. They move to slums. They move to the edge of Abuja, and I write about this in the book. They move to the edge of Abuja, and the kids who used to pay for their schooling by farming now pay for their schooling by begging. And it's these young people who are absolutely recruited for Boko Haram and all other kinds of nefarious activities. So there isn't a lot of Saudi funding in terms of these kind of schools yet, but this certainly points to exactly the same problem that we saw in Pakistan, where a lack of education and a lack of resources leads to a radicalized population.
Well, Eliza, I feel that we need to revisit this subject, have a subsequent conversation, because we've run out of time. But I'd love to get more of your poet sensibility in terms of being a journalist. And it certainly comes across in your new book, The 10th Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
And thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'll take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with economist Dean Baker. Siri pockets de magalande, man go.